A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to talk about Wi-Fi planning, and he's basically framed it as two ways to get it wrong. The first is the hope and pray method. You plug in whatever plastic box your ISP gave you, stick it in the corner, and assume it'll cover the whole house. Spoiler, it doesn't. The second is the overcorrection. You buy a 3-pack mesh system, scatter nodes everywhere, and accidentally turn your network into a traffic jam of backhaul channels fighting each other. The smarter way, he says, is to approach it like an architect. Actually plan your coverage, take real measurements, and only then buy hardware.
The timing on this is perfect, because we're now at the point where Wi-Fi 7 gear is actually on shelves, and the cost of guessing wrong has never been higher.
Explain that part. Why does Wi-Fi 7 make bad planning more expensive?
Wider channels, more bands, more backhaul options, all of which sound great until you realize there are also more ways to accidentally sabotage yourself. Wi-Fi 7 introduces 320 MHz channels. That's enormous bandwidth, but it also means the 6 GHz band goes from having about 7 non-overlapping channels at 160 MHz down to just 3. So if you're the type who buys a mesh system and scatters 4 nodes around a 1200 square foot apartment, those nodes are now fighting over an even smaller pool of clean airspace.
The margin for error shrinks as the capability expands. That's a neat little trap.
It's the classic more rope to hang yourself with situation. And here's the thing, most people don't even know they're in the trap. They see Wi-Fi 7 on the box, they see mesh on the box, they assume the technology will figure it out. But the physics doesn't care about the marketing.
The router can't out-negotiate a concrete wall.
And that's really the heart of what Daniel's getting at. There's this whole discipline of Wi-Fi planning that treats your house like a coverage problem to be modeled and measured, not a guessing game. You map the space, you account for what the walls are made of, you figure out where signal actually goes and where it doesn't, and only then do you decide how many access points you need and where they go.
Which is the exact opposite of how 99% of people do it. Most folks buy the hardware first, then wander around the house holding their phone up like a dowsing rod, trying to find the one spot where Netflix doesn't buffer.
The dowsing rod approach. I've seen it, I've done it, I've been that person in my own home before I knew better.
We've all been that person. The question is whether we stay that person in the Wi-Fi 7 era, when the stakes are higher and the interference landscape is more crowded.
That's what makes this worth digging into, because the tools to do this properly have gotten genuinely accessible. You don't need to be a network engineer with a $2,000 Ekahau license anymore. There are apps on your phone right now that can give you 80% of the insight you need. The gap between, I guess this is fine, and I know exactly what my network is doing, has never been smaller.
Let's break down what actually goes wrong when you don't plan, and why the fix isn't just buying more hardware.
There are really two distinct failure modes here, and they're almost opposites of each other. The first one is what I'd call the hope and pray approach, and this is probably 80% of households. You get the router from your ISP, you plug it in wherever the cable comes into the house, and you assume it'll cover everything. It doesn't. The signal hits a concrete wall or a floor and drops 20 decibels, and suddenly your bedroom is a dead zone. Your garage may as well be on the moon, and you're also getting hammered by your neighbor's router blasting away on the exact same channel.
Co-channel interference from the guy next door, who also plugged his ISP router into the corner and called it a day. It's a tragedy of the commons played out in 2.4 gigahertz.
And then there's the second failure pattern, which is the overcorrection. Someone reads a blog post about mesh systems, decides more is always better, and drops 4 or 5 nodes into a 1,200 square foot apartment. Each node is transmitting backhaul traffic to the others, and if they're too close together, those backhaul transmissions start competing with the actual client traffic your devices are trying to send. You've spent $400 to make your network worse.
Under-provisioning gives you dead zones, and over-provisioning gives you a network that's technically alive but functionally useless. Both come from the same root problem. You never measured anything.
And that's the mindset shift Daniel's pointing toward. Wi-Fi planning isn't really about signal strength in isolation. It's about understanding how radio waves propagate through your specific space, what the walls are made of, where the interference sources are, what your actual client density looks like. Signal strength, or RSSI, is just one variable. You also need to care about signal-to-noise ratio, channel utilization, packet error rates. A strong signal on a crowded channel can perform worse than a moderate signal on a clean one.
The architect's approach isn't, how many bars do I have? It's, what is the actual usable throughput at every point where I'm going to sit down with a device?
And you model that before you spend a dollar on hardware. You map the floor plan, you account for attenuation through walls and floors, you figure out where the dead zones actually are, and then you decide how many access points you need and where they go. You validate with real measurements afterward. It's the difference between guessing and knowing.
Guessing got us through the Wi-Fi 5 and 6 eras because the penalties were smaller. Fewer bands, simpler channel layouts, less crowding. But with Wi-Fi 7 and those 320 MHz channels you mentioned, guessing wrong doesn't just leave you with a slow corner of the living room. It can tank the whole network.
The tools to do this properly have quietly gotten good enough that there's no real excuse anymore. But we'll get to those. To understand how to plan properly, we have to look under the hood at how Wi-Fi signals actually behave in a real building. And the tools that do this well, Ikahau, NetSpot, they're not just drawing pretty heat maps, they're running physics models.
You're saying my ISP router doesn't do this?
Your ISP router is a hopeful little box with an antenna and a dream. These planning tools use something called RF propagation modeling. At its core, it's ray tracing, the same idea used in computer graphics, except instead of tracing light rays bouncing off surfaces, you're tracing radio waves passing through walls, floors, furniture. The tool needs to know what those obstacles are made of, because different materials attenuate the signal differently.
Attenuate meaning weaken, create awaken, but no weaken readin.
And the numbers are surprisingly specific. The ITU Indoor Propagation Model, that's the International Telecommunication Union, they maintain the standard reference, gives you per material loss figures. Drywall, about 3 decibels. Glass, around 5. A concrete wall? That's a factor of 32 in terms of actual power reduction.
One concrete wall turns a perfectly good 5 GHz connection into something that barely works.
This is exactly what Ikahau's predictive heat maps show. You import a floor plan, you assign building materials to each wall. This one's drywall, this one's concrete, this one's glass. Then you place virtual access points on the map and run the simulation. The tool calculates expected signal strength at every point in the space, accounting for every wall the signal has to punch through. There's a classic example from their documentation. You place an AP, everything looks fine. Then the heat map hits a concrete wall and you see an immediate 20 decibel cliff. The planned 5 GHz connection drops straight to 2.4 GHz fallback on the other side of that wall.
2.4 is the slow lane. More range, but crowded and capped on throughput.
And here's where it gets more interesting. Ikahau doesn't just show you signal strength. That heat map is actually calculating expected data rates at every point, not bars, megabits per second. Because their whole philosophy, and they've written about this extensively, is that coverage alone doesn't guarantee performance.
Coverage versus performance.
Coverage is RSSI, Received Signal Strength Indicator. How loud the router is at your device. Performance is whether you can actually stream video or load a web page. And the gap between those two things is where most home networks die. You need to also care about SNR, Signal to Noise Ratio, which is how much louder your router is than the background noise and interference. You need to care about channel utilization, which is what percentage of airtime on a given channel is already occupied by other devices and neighboring networks. You need to care about packet error rates, how many frames are arriving corrupted and need to be retransmitted.
You could have a screaming loud signal at minus 50 dBm, but if the noise floor is also high, or the channel is saturated, or you're getting a 10% packet error rate, that minus 50 is meaningless.
And NetSpot Survey Mode makes this brutally visible. They have a signal-to-noise ratio view where you can walk your space and see, point by point, what the actual SNR is. There's a scenario that shows up all the time. You're standing in a spot with full bars, RSSI looks great, but NetSpot reveals you've got adjacent channel interference bleeding over from a neighbor's router parked on channel 6. Your SNR is 5 dB. That's terrible. Meanwhile, a spot two rooms over with a weaker signal but 25 dB of SNR will perform dramatically better.
The bars on your phone are lying to you constantly.
The bars are a single number trying to summarize a multivariable equation. It's like judging a car by how loud the engine is.
Which brings us to the other half of this, the coverage versus capacity trade-off. You mentioned it earlier, but walk me through the physics of what happens when too many clients pile onto one access point.
Wi-Fi is a shared medium. Only one device can transmit at a time on a given channel. So if you've got a single AP in a room showing minus 50 dBm everywhere, great coverage, but 30 clients are all trying to talk to it simultaneously. They're taking turns. Each device gets a fraction of the available airtime. Throughput per device collapses. It doesn't matter that the signal is strong. The channel is the bottleneck.
Proper planning means deciding upfront whether a given zone needs blanket coverage or high-density capacity.
That's the distinction. Blanket coverage is for IoT sensors, smart thermostats, things that send tiny packets occasionally and just need to stay connected. You can stretch one AP across a lot of square footage for that. High-density capacity is for a living room where someone's streaming 4K video, someone else is gaming, and a third person is on a video call, all simultaneously. That zone might need its own AP, even if the signal from the next room technically reaches it. Because technically reaches and actually works under load are two completely different things.
The planning tools let you model both scenarios before you drill a single hole in the wall.
That's the whole point. You place virtual APs, you set your client density assumptions, you run the predictive model, and you see where the bottlenecks are going to be before they exist. NetSpot's workflow is a bit more accessible for home users. You upload a map image, you trace the walls, you drop APs onto it, and it generates the heat map overlay. Their home tier is $49 a year, which includes both the predictive mode and the survey mode for walking the space afterward. Ekahau is the professional grade tool. Their license runs north of $2,000, but it gives you packet level metrics, full protocol analysis, and integration with their purpose, built Sidekick scanner. Different tools for different needs, same underlying physics.
The predictive model is step one. But you said something important a minute ago. You validate with real measurements afterward. The model is a hypothesis. You still have to test it.
That's where the over-provisioning trap gets especially ugly, because it's not just a predictive modeling problem. It's something you can actually measure and watch happen in real time.
Walk me through the physics of what happens when someone puts mesh nodes too close together. You mentioned backhaul interference earlier, but what's actually colliding with what?
Think of it this way. In a mesh system, every node has two jobs. It has to talk to your devices. That's the client-facing traffic. And it has to talk to the other nodes to pass that traffic back to the main router. That second job is the backhaul. If you place nodes 15 feet apart, they're screaming backhaul traffic at each other on the same channel, and your phone trying to load a web page is now competing with a node-to-node conversation happening at the exact same frequency.
The mesh is essentially shouting over its own conversation.
Wi-Fi 7 makes this worse. Those 320 MHz channels I mentioned, they're spectacular for throughput, but they also mean the 6 GHz band now has only 3 non-overlapping channels. If your mesh backhaul is on 6 GHz and your client traffic is also on 6 GHz, and you've got nodes close enough that their coverage circles overlap heavily, you've just created a self-jamming network.
The wider the channel, the fewer lanes available, and the more carefully you have to plan who's driving in which lane.
And here's a concrete case that shows up all the time. 1500 square foot house, someone buys a 3-node Wi-Fi 6E mesh system. They unbox it, put one node in the living room, one in the hallway, one in the bedroom, ends up being about 15 feet between each node in a rough triangle. Looks reasonable on paper. But the backhaul on 6 GHz is saturating the band, and clients on 5 GHz are seeing 50% throughput loss. Not because the hardware is bad, because the geometry is bad.
What's the fix? Just move them further apart?
That's what the measurement tells you. Same person runs a NetSpot survey, walks the house with their phone, takes readings in every room at seated height. not floor level, that's important, because Wi-Fi behaves differently at the height where your devices actually are. They discover that the far end of the house, about 40 feet from the nearest node, is actually still getting a usable signal, so they move one node out there. Now the backhaul has enough physical separation that the signals aren't stomping on each other, and client throughput doubles.
From moving one box 40 feet.
From measuring instead of guessing. And the survey itself is not complicated. You walk the space systematically. Every room, at the height where you actually use devices, which is seated height, roughly 3 to 4 feet off the ground. You note every spot where signal drops below minus 70 dBm, because that's the typical threshold where reliable video streaming starts to fall apart. Netflix buffering, Zoom freezing, that's the minus 70 cliff.
You don't need a $2,000 Ekahau license to do this.
You absolutely don't. NetSpot's home tier is $49 a year, and it gives you both the predictive heat mapping and the survey mode. On Android, Wi-Fi Analyzer is free and gives you RSSI per channel, channel utilization, a real-time graph of signal strength as you walk. Is it as precise as an Ekahau sidekick? The sidekick has calibrated antennas. It can measure packet-level metrics like retries and CRC errors, which a phone's Wi-Fi chip simply doesn't expose. A phone gives you RSSI and channel noise, but not packet loss.
For someone trying to fix their home network, phone-level data is probably enough.
More than enough. It's 80% of the insight for 0% of the cost. The key is being systematic about it. Don't just wave your phone around. Walk to each spot where you actually sit down with a device, hold the phone at seated height, wait a few seconds for the reading to stabilize, note the number. If you're below minus 70, that's where you need another node, or where you need to reposition one you already have.
The workflow is, predictive model first to figure out roughly where things should go, then walk the space with the phone to validate, then adjust. Not buy a mesh system and hope the app's auto-placement wizard knows what your walls are made of.
That auto-placement wizard, by the way, has no idea. It's optimizing for signal strength between nodes, not for what happens to your client traffic when the backhaul saturates. It's a perfect little machine for generating the over-provisioning failure pattern we've been talking about.
Which brings us back to the practical question. What does someone actually do with all this? First thing, before you buy anything, draw a floor plan. Doesn't have to be architectural blueprints. Just a rough sketch of your space. Walls marked, rooms labeled. Then grab a free tool. Wi-Fi Analyzer on Android. Or NetSpot's free tier, and take readings at the spots where you'd consider putting an access point. What you're hunting for is anywhere the signal drops below minus 70 dBm. That's your needs another node line. Below that, video streaming gets shaky, calls drop, the whole thing degrades.
The floor plan matters because it forces you to think about what's between point A and point B. That wall you've been ignoring for 5 years? If it's concrete, it's eating 15 decibels. Your floor plan tells you that before you even take a reading.
Second thing, if you're using a mesh system, give the node some breathing room. 30 to 40 feet apart in typical residential construction. Drywall, wood studs, that's the standard. Closer than 30 feet, you're paying for backhaul interference whether you realize it or not. And if your mesh supports a dedicated backhaul band, 6 gigahertz or even better, wired Ethernet, use it. Take the backhaul conversation off the client channels entirely.
Wired backhaul is the cheat code. If you can run an Ethernet cable between nodes, you just eliminated the entire self-interference problem. The mesh becomes a set of coordinated access points instead of a radio shouting match.
Third, stop looking at bars. Your phone's bar display is doing public relations for your Wi-Fi, not reporting the truth. What you actually want is SNR. A signal at minus 50 dBm with 5 dB of SNR is garbage. A signal at minus 75 with 25 dB of SNR will run circles around it. Use a tool that shows SNR, not just RSSI. Wi-Fi Analyzer does this. NetSpot does this. It's the difference between feeling good about your network and actually having one that works.
All three of these are weekend projects. Not call a consultant projects, not learn RF engineering projects. Draw the floor plan, walk the space with your phone, check the numbers, move a node or two. That's it. The gap between guessing and knowing is about 2 hours of your time and possibly $0.
Which is a much better deal than $400 on a mesh system that's accidentally jamming itself.
We've got the weekend plan. But here's the open question I keep turning over. As Wi-Fi 7 becomes the default and the 6 GHz band fills up, does this kind of manual planning become mandatory for everyone, or do the mesh systems finally get smart enough to do it themselves?
That's the bet the mesh companies are making, right? Self-optimizing. The box figures out channel assignments and backhaul routing so you don't have to. And to be fair, they've gotten better. But better and good enough to handle 3 non-overlapping channels with 4 nodes in a small apartment are different things.
This is where the AI-driven planning tools get interesting. Ikahau has their AI Pro feature now. You upload a photo of your floor plan, and it automatically suggests AP placements based on the geometry and materials it detects. NetSpot's got their own AI heat map that does something similar. The machine learning is doing the propagation modeling for you.
The expert-level planning becomes accessible, but it's still planning. You're just outsourcing the thinking to a model instead of doing it yourself, which is different from the mesh system claiming it'll figure everything out on the fly.
A predictive model that says put the node here before you buy is fundamentally different from a mesh system that tries to fix bad placement after the fact. One prevents the problem, the other manages the symptoms.
I think that's the real through line. The tools are getting smarter, but the physics isn't changing. Concrete still eats 15 decibels, whether an AI points it out or you do.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1930s, researchers studying sharks off the Azores discovered that the ampullae of Lorenzini, the electroreceptive organs in a shark's snout, can detect electric fields as weak as 5 billionths of a volt per centimeter, and a single hammerhead may carry over 3,000 of these sensory pores across its head.
That's unsettling.
So to land this, the question isn't really whether you should plan your Wi-Fi. It's whether 5 years from now you'll even have to think about it, or whether the planning just happens invisibly before you ever open a box. And I suspect the answer is somewhere in the middle. The tools will get better, but the person who measures will always have a better network than the person who trusts the wizard.
This has been My Weird Prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If this episode saved you from buying a mesh system you didn't need, rate us 5 stars and tell a friend who's still using their ISP's router.
We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.